Professor Andrew McNaughton is one of the world's leading experts on high-speed rail systems. He's currently Technical Director of High Speed 2, a planned high-speed railway in the United Kingdom, which aims to become the new backbone of the national rail network, linking London, Birmingham, the East Midlands, Leeds and Manchester. The chairman of the Committee for Sydney, Michael Rose, discussed with him the question of whether Australia should build a high-speed rail network linking the major cities on the East Coast.
We're here today with Professor Andrew McNaughton, the Technical Director of High Speed Rail 2. Andrew, welcome to Sydney.
Thanks, Michael.
Here in Australia, we know a little bit about High Speed Rail 2, or HS2. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about the genesis of the project and its objectives.
Well, that's the most important question. Why are we doing it? The principal objectives are twofold. One is to introduce major new capacity between our big cities on the north-south access out of London, connecting them to each other and connecting them to the capital city, bringing them all within an hour of each other, which is the critical point where cities kind of come together, people come together. So there we are, it's new capacity, and it's this shorter journey time that shrinks the country, but it makes it possible for people to live in places other than the capital city.
I understand that earlier in your career you were involved in HS1, the high-speed rail link between London and Paris. Were there any lessons learnt in that project that have been applied to HS2?
I think there's one really huge lesson, and that was people always think about our first high-speed line as London to Paris. Very long distance, the equivalent of a kind of, I guess, Sydney to Melbourne. But actually, not that many people travel very long distance. You'd never build all that infrastructure and all those trains for such little traffic. What we learned was this kind of magical 1 hour meant that with a new line, the whole area of Kent, southeast from London, became accessible from London. This was an area that used to be industrial, dying on its feet, really. Mm. Now it's a thriving area. Property prices have gone up 50, 60%. More to the point, lots of people now live and commute into London because it's within an hour of their work. It may be 160 kilometres away, but it's that one magical 1 hour.
So if you take that idea then, that the connecting of communities along the high-speed line, HS2 is going to touch a great many communities, either because it stops there or because it runs through there. What has the process of engaging those communities been like? And how is the opportunity of HS2 being described to those communities?
For the major cities, from the very start, we've worked in conjunction with them, in cooperation, to decide where in the cities it's best to build a new station so that they take the maximum opportunity to regenerate city areas that otherwise were not going anywhere. They're, if you like, the that's very easy conversation because they're, if you think of them as the winners from this, we're doing it for all of them. But Britain is the most heavily populated country in Europe. So we pass through and by an awful lot of communities between the cities. And that's a much harder discussion because they're not such obvious winners. I mean, the alternatives to High Speed 2 might have been new motorways. Mm. That's not really the point. The point is you have to talk to them and adjust your plans, not tell them what you're going to do to them, but how best to pass the railway, pass their village, pass the town, how you mitigate noise, the effects, but also, and this is another thing we learned, how you mitigate construction, where the lorries are going to go. Mm. And until you've got that worked out in some detail, the conversation with just talks in generalities is not much use. So again, a learning there was we had to really work through how do we minimize the effects on people and the natural environment, then go out and talk to them, listen, come back, adjust the plans. We've held 17 public consultations for the first 230 kilometers about all sorts of things, from the route itself to property compensation, whatever. So it's a continual discussion. They're not going to love you, but at least they understand that you're listening to them.
Yeah. To what extent has the route been able to take advantage of existing or historic corridors, and to what extent have you had to adjust the route to take into account the kinds of community issues that you've just referred to?
The corridors that we're using, to some degree, are historic corridors because simply they're connecting the principal cities. Mm. But the old transport corridors were designed for freight or from another era, when railways and roads almost followed the contours like canals.
Yeah.
And a high-speed railway is pretty straight.
Mm.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be high speed.
Yeah.
So we are cutting through new countryside. We're cutting through old past communities that have been tranquil, and explaining that that's the logic, and that the alternative routes were less good. Again, we spent many more hours assessing routes that we other people have suggested that we knew we weren't in the end going to take, to demonstrate that the route that was put forward was a better route than the alternatives.
So in Australia, of course, we have smaller population centres that tend to be further apart than they are in the UK, and often have a lot of empty space between them. Do you think that Australia is a feasible environment for high-speed rail of the kind that HS2 represents?
If you think that the key, if the problem you're trying to solve is how you bring together communities that are too far apart at the moment to make it sustainable for people to live and work other than in the biggest cities, then yes. The high-speed rail is at its most effective within that kind of 1 to 2 hour radius of a metropolis. And you start to think of distance in terms of time rather than kilometres. Mm. But if you convert that to kilometres, then you think of about a 200 to 250 kilometre radius, maybe a bit more for that 1 hour, and maybe 500 kilometres for the 2 hours. But the big prize is that 1 hour, that 200 mm. to 250 kilometres. And I suppose if you think of Sydney, you're thinking, I don't know, Newcastle to the mm. north, Wollongong, Canberra to the south. That's all within an hour if you take high-speed rail seriously.
Mm. And are there examples outside the UK that you think might be useful examples for Australia to look at more closely? Spain, for example, or parts of the French network?
I would suggest that, because I lead the World Committee, I think I know most of the networks pretty well. You have to look, one of the ones that has most influence on us was in Japan, not the original line, which just strings together big cities, and you couldn't say that Australia was like that. Mm. But the line that runs north out of Tokyo, that if you imagine it's like a tree with a big trunk, and then trains go off on branches. So you've got an intensively used corridor into Tokyo, and then trains go to smaller places, but they all benefit because they all get brought much, much, much closer to the capital city, where there's finance and where there's legal firms and all those sort of specialist things. There's bits of France that work on the same basis, this idea of a tree with a trunk and branches. And that's really what we're doing. Other places you've suggested, I don't think it's so appropriate.
Right. You mentioned that one of the things that was involved in the community consultation was speaking with communities about the optimum places to put stations in different towns in order to drive revitalization.
Yes.
Where do you think that's been done most well? What are some examples that you've seen of very forward thinking in terms of the location of terminals?
If I turn to France, then the first line from Paris to Lyon, they chose, rather than to reinforce the existing centre of Lyon, to build a new station about just over half a kilometre out of the centre in an old rundown area, which is now the commercial quarter.
Right.
It hasn't abstracted people from the old centre. It's added to the city. And that's probably the most powerful example in a city I know. And when we've developed High Speed 2, then our second city, Birmingham, is done. We're doing exactly the same thing. And we're doing exactly the same thing in Leeds and in Manchester. We're extending the city and providing a new opportunity for growth rather than just reinforcing the existing centre. Of course, in the capital, it's much more difficult because it's already built out. Mm-hmm. And there, what you're basically doing is providing access that's most convenient into the business heart of the city, because that drives the scheme. I'll give you one other example for a smaller city, which again is French actually, which is Lille in northern France. And that's at the point where the high-speed line towards London and towards Brussels and Germany bifurcates. Again, they built, rather than building in the existing, they built half a kilometre away again, maybe a little bit more, in an area which was just flattened warehouses. And that is also, if you go and see it, glass and steel and the centre of a new commercial area with far more employment than they had before.
Infrastructure Australia recently issued a report in which they stress the importance of rail to manage growing population in Australian cities, and in particular to join together the very large cities like Sydney. Do you have some thoughts on that?
There's different forms of high-speed rail, and you can be stuck slightly on the title. From very high speed, which is what we're using in Britain, through to, I suppose, what you call fast rail. But at 200 to 250 kilometres an hour, it's still pretty fast. If you think of using that kind of conventional technology, then you can still join up the centres of a mega city such as Sydney in 10 or 15 minutes. So instead of being maybe 45 minutes apart, which at that point they're virtually separate cities, they don't work together. If you bring them within about 15 minutes of each other, then it's like a few stops on the metro. Think of it as a high-speed metro, not stopping every bus stop, but joining up those principal areas. And I see a trend developing to use higher speed rail with very big cities, of which clearly Sydney is one, just like in London. And that way you can stop it, you can give it centres, and each of those centres has its own transport system. So you're joining the city together with a new form of transport. It's not cheap, but it's the most effective way I know of holding together a city that spreads over 20 or 30 kilometres.
In Australia, there's been a conversation about high-speed rail perhaps for 50 years, and I'm not sure everybody understands what high-speed rail is. What is your definition of high-speed rail for HS2?
High-speed rail is developed as a system separate from the conventional railway that's going between the places you want to connect in the 21st century. And because it's its own railway, even if it then spreads trains out at the ends onto the conventional railway so that more places are served, that high-speed core is very reliable, completely safe, and allows trains to move, in our case, at up to 360 kilometres an hour. We're only going at that speed because with the numbers of people we've got, every minute pays back hugely. But other places where there's perhaps not quite the intensity of service, or the geography is more difficult, then high-speed rail is still 250 kilometres an hour, or 230 kilometres an hour. It's basically, I suppose you'd say, anything above about 200 kilometres an hour.
So as I understand it, the cost of HS2 is £55 billion. How did the government in the UK determine that was going to be value for money for the UK? And what are the elements of the value that it sees HS2 bringing to the nation?
There's two elements of value. What we call the direct transport assessment value. And that says if a effectively a quarter of a million people a day are using high speed too, and we're saving each of those people an hour of their lives. What's that worth? So half the value of high speed two is time saving. Another quarter or so is the value of reliability. The fact that on a high speed lines, the trains will arrive to the minute. Huge difference.
Yeah.
And it is built to accommodate climate change and all those sorts of things. The other quarter is that we release the capacity on the existing lines, because we transfer all this traffic away from, well, not just railways, but roads, where it frees up capacity, which can then be used for new communities, maybe along the highway or along the existing railway. So that's that double benefit. That's the direct transport benefits. The indirect benefits are how it causes cities to grow. Not just the property growth around the stations, but because each of the stations has got a local transport system connecting to it, the way you spread new jobs, and where jobs come, housing comes after it, into our growing cities. And we're seeing it already in Birmingham, where there wasn't a single tower crane before High Speed 2 was announced. Now there's 30 or 40. They're building the place out. Companies have announced they're moving out to Birmingham, creating new jobs. Tens of thousands of jobs. And a final benefit, which people often overlook, is building this railway is tens of thousands of new jobs. And people will say, oh, but you don't do high-speed rail. Where are these, where are you going to get the skills from? So we've already opened two skills colleges in areas where there weren't too many employment opportunities in the north of England, for people to come and learn new artisan skills to build a high-speed railway to millimetre tolerances. So those are what we call the strategic benefits, but they're just as measurable in, for us, pound notes, as the direct transport benefits.
A final question. You've had a long and illustrious career in railways.
You mean I'm old?
What's the really exciting thing about HS2 for you? What's the most exciting element of it as far as you're concerned?
This may sound a bit corny, but we're building a railway that will help the country prosper for the next 100, 150, 200 years. This is not a flash in the pan. And with that responsibility, you're only going to do it once. You've got to get it right. And you've got to build it to the highest quality you can. And that's what drives pretty much everybody that's involved with it. We're helping to build the future of the country.
Well, on that note, Professor Andrew McNaughton, thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.